This is Katie Ruther speaking with Ben Gleason on May 12th, 2020.
Myself and my two brothers to Connecticut, where she was part owner in a farm there. And the farm was something that, I don't know, it went back to actual King's Grant to my ancestors. So this was Southern Connecticut, Old Saber, because you know where that is. And I spent from the time I was 7 years old until I went away for high school, the last 2 years of high school, I spent there on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
And my job was to help my mother do the dishes and prepare food. And my two brothers did most of the farm work. So we had some cows and we bottled milk right there in our kitchen and sold it to the neighbors. Illegal thing to do, I guess. But anyway, I went to college and I got a degree and I worked for a year and I said, geez, I hated being in a city and working indoors all the time. So in an office. So I quit that job and I went traveling in Europe. And one of my last trips before I started getting involved in agriculture, I went to Corfu, Greece. And I spent a winter there, 3 months in Corfu, Greece. And I just loved the way of life there. People were very relaxed. They grew, you know, most of their own food.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty self-sufficient kind of people. And with the climate that they have there, we were eating fresh vegetables, you know, all winter from the neighbor's gardens.
Wow.
So I came back to the United States thinking that that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to live a life that's where I could produce my own food and make a living some other way and so forth. But one of the first things that I did was buy a goat because when I was in Greece, I saw a lot of goats, and I actually saw some of them who climb olive trees and go out on the branches and graze the leaves on the branches of the olive trees.
Wow.
Never saw anything like it before or since. But I really enjoyed the goats, and they're just such characters. So at some point we still had a little bit of land from the farm, about maybe 6 or 8 acres of tillable land, and so I started farming that. And my brother came back from Europe and he helped me. He was not as interested in it as I was, but we had at one point we had 8 goats I was milking every day and a cow, and then I would make cheese and sell that to friends. So and yogurt. I also sold yogurt. So that kind of got me going, and I started reading Organic Garden magazine and a little magazine called Countryside. Jerry Bellinger, yes, I think he's long gone by now, but he was a Midwestern small farmer. And he wrote a book mostly about livestock, but he also raised his own feed for his livestock. And so he got me interested in raising my own feed, and I ended up, we're still in Connecticut now, and I found a combine for sale there, so I started raising some grains down there.
Hmm.
And we lived in a town where we had pretty much the only farm in town, and nobody had any respect for that at all. And I just got tired of, I don't know, it's kind of a make money area where you can, you know, the whole idea is to make as much money as you can in your life, and that wasn't my objective. So I decided to, so my brother and I decided to move to Vermont. So we bought a piece of land in Vermont, in Bridgeport, and started actually farming there with, you know, to try to making, try to make a money, trying to make money off the farm. So the first thing we started doing was to grow grains and get cattle here and so forth. So it all kind of led up to what I ended up doing. And I guess I had some, a book by Gene Logsdon, which was printed, I don't know, in the early 70s, I believe. And that was kind of my Bible for raising grains, and it's called Small Scale Grain Raising. And he was from Ohio, and he was a big fan of Ollis Chalmers All Crop Combines, which were a pulled type PTO combine. And so that was when we moved to Vermont. That was the first combine we bought. And after a few years, it got to be too small for what we wanted to do. But we started out with maybe 2 acres of wheat, and then tried to find some markets for it. And started our first market was Middlebury Natural Foods Co-op. And we bought a small grain mill from a company that was going out of business. And then it kind of led from there. So, yeah, I really started my agricultural, or practicing agriculture in 1973 in Connecticut. And then we moved to Vermont in, we bought the property in Vermont in 79. So we moved to Vermont. I built 2 houses on the property, and then in 2018, we decided. My wife had been telling me for a long time that I needed to slow down, and it didn't seem like that was very practical because there was still a lot of demand for what I was doing. And I just decided, well, I guess I'll have to quit and sell the farm, which is what we did.
Wow. So at the height of your operation, how much land were you farming?
I was farming 125 acres of tillable land.
Wow. And did you own all of that land, or were you leasing some of it?
No. I was leasing about half of it, I guess.
In addition to wheat, were you growing other grains?
Yeah, I tried a lot of different things over the years. I tried hullless barley. This was early on. This was probably in the early 80s. And there was no market for it, but it was interesting to grow. Grew it for a couple of years. And I grew oats. That was probably the first crop that I planted in Bridgeport when we moved there. It was oats. We were going to feed those to our cattle, and they didn't really like the oats very well. You had to put molasses on them to get them to eat them. So I have grown soybeans. And I've grown black beans, and I grew clover for seed. And I used to produce hay, and I sold that to a neighbor who had a horse farm just down the road from me, and I would get the manure back from her to spread on my fields. And I sold straw as well. And really, when the demand of straw was starting to really increase, I was talking to Jack Laser, you know, about Jack, mm-hmm. probably.
Uh-huh, yep.
I was talking to Jack, and he said, well, he said, you know, I feel like you're, like, when you're baling straw, you're selling your organic matter off your farm. And I guess I didn't know that, but I was, you know, it was still in the more beginning stages there, and I had to get some money somewhere, mm-hmm. and I wasn't growing that many grains at the time, so I just stopped selling straw and started just chopping it back onto the field.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. So how many varieties of wheat were you growing?
Oh, boy. Over the years, quite a few. Now, I don't remember what year it was. It was more than 10 years ago, anyway, when Heather Darby became an extension agent up in St. Albans.
Uh-huh.
And Heather got to be friends with Jack, and because I was growing grains as well, kind of started a little program with growing, you know, with grain growing. So and it's really burgeoned to, you know, quite a big thing with her research center up in Aalborg.
Mm-hmm.
And so that really made a big difference in you know, connections with other people.
Mm-hmm.
And Heather was really interested in trying to find the right grains, especially for organic growers, the right grains for our climate.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did a lot of field testing,
mm-hmm.
Not only in St. Albans, but also on individual farms throughout the state. So. Mm-hmm. So I took part in that, which was really a fun thing. You start out with, you know, maybe with a handful of seed.
Mm-hmm.
And then Heather managed to come with a plot combine, which is, I don't know what you know about it, but
not too much.
It's a very small. Yeah, it's a very small combine. And the nice thing about that combine is it's pretty easy to clean.
Uh-huh.
So you can go and combine a strip of grain,
mm-hmm.
and then, you know, clean the combine quickly and go and start in on the next strip, which would be in a different variety.
Hmm.
You know, so you can keep your varieties separate, or at least mostly separate.
Mm-hmm.
So you always get some seed that comes from one plot to another. But, that was really a fun part of the whole farming operation, was to just see what you could come up with and save some seed and start planting it on a larger scale. And yeah, mm. so that was great.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
So what channels were you selling your grains through?
Well, I started out with Middlebury Natural Foods Co-op.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody suggested that I contact O'Bread Bakery in Shelburne.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, they had a stone flour mill up there.
Hmm.
And so I started selling them wheat berries.
Uh-huh.
And the mill that I bought initially was just an 8-inch. You know, it's a Meadows mill made in North Carolina. And it was called a home mill, but you know, you could do 100 pounds in 2 hours or so.
Wow.
But the real problem with it was you couldn't really get a fine ground grain with it, and especially the brand tended to not grind up.
Hmm.
Very, very fine. And so there wasn't a anywhere near as much market for that as there was for, you know, something that was more highly processed.
Mm-hmm.
So, eventually, Old Red Bakery, their mill, the stones got so worn that it wasn't worth fixing it. They sold their mill. They just started buying flour. I sold them flour for a little while, and then Red Hen Bakery started mm-hmm. up in, where was it? Outside of Waterbury.
Mm-hmm.
And now they've moved to where they are now. But I'd been selling flour locally to, a number of bakeries and small bakeries. And there was a guy who worked at, and all this time, I never did any real advertising or anything. It was pretty much word of mouth. There was a guy who worked at Otter Creek Bakery in mm-hmm. Middlebury, uh-huh. which you're familiar with, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And I started selling them flour from the time they opened their wow. operation. And one of the guys that worked there moved to Montpelier and started working for Old Red Bakery, and he told Randy George, who owns Red Hen,
mm-hmm.
he told Randy George that he should try some of my flour. And so I milled some up and took it over there, and he ended up becoming by far my biggest customer.
Mm. So. Wow. That's amazing.
So that's kind of the flour story.
Yeah. So how were your prices comparing to those of more conventionally grown grains?
Well, right from the beginning, it was not something I wanted to sell my flour at a price that I felt anybody could afford.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, making a lot of money was never high on my list of priorities. And so I'm not sure what the price of non-organic commercial flour was when I started, but I think I started selling at 30 cents a pound.
Mm.
And by the time I finished and sold my farm, I was charging Randy George, Red Hen Bakery, I was charging them 70 cents a pound, and for the smaller, most everybody else, I was charging 80 cents a pound.
Hmm.
So you know, if you looked at my flour, it was always of locally grown stuff. It was always the cheapest.
Hmm.
Locally grown, organic.
Uh huh. Well, that's a good segue. I'd love to talk more about organic specifically now.
Okay.
So my first question would just be, what does organic mean to you?
What organic means to me is the safest way to provide quality foods to people.
Yeah. And what would you say the role of organic is in today's food system?
Well, certainly it's, unfortunately, it's because of our agricultural system in the States, it's a more expensive thing for consumers, and so it tends to target people who can afford to buy it, which is really unfortunate. One of the things that I learned, probably 8 or more years ago, is that most of the wheat that's grown in the United States and in Canada, and even in other parts of the world too, but mostly the United States and Canada, because we're doing it on such a large scale, the farmers go in and they spray their crops with Roundup to kill them. So this weed is mature, and it gets sprayed with Roundup, so that any kind of weeds are in it, or wheat doesn't always mature. Mostly, it doesn't mature really evenly. So you can have grain out there that's ready to harvest, and you can have some that's still kind of green. So the Roundup kind of takes care of the problem, but it's in your food system. I keep thinking I've got to start writing letters in the newspapers about what's going on, because almost nobody knows this. And, you know, at this point, if you're not eating organic grains, you're probably eating Roundup.
So it sounds like you were growing organically from the beginning.
I did. When I came back from Greece in 73, I started reading Organic Gardening magazine, and I just started using those principles right away.
Were you ever certified organic?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you were certified for a number of years then?
Yes. Because I was selling the Oak Bread Bakery, I had to get certified.
What would you say your view on organic certification is?
I think Vermont does a really good job. In some cases, I think they carry it a little bit too far. I've had inspections where I think, oh my God, you're asking something that just isn't totally practical, you know?
Yeah.
I never had a problem getting certification. I had to sometimes write letters to NOFA stating my position, so I felt like, you know, I was getting fair treatment, I guess.
So when you...
I think one of the problems here in Vermont is there are so few grain growers that the inspectors don't really know anything about growing grain. So it's that made it difficult.
Yeah, that makes sense. Would you say, in your experience with all of the farmers you've worked with, is there a sort of gap in understanding of organic that exists amongst organic farmers?
Well, yeah, I think there, to a certain degree, there is. For me, I'd spent, a lot of time and energy in trying to build up the organic matter in the soil, and, you know, then you get somebody that wants to constantly graze it, and you think, oh my God.
Yeah. And do you have any sense of how conventional farmers view organic?
Oh yeah, I do. Yes, in Bridport, we have mostly conventional farmers, big dairy farms. And basically they say, well, there's not hardly any difference between what we're doing and what the organic people are doing. And which tells me that they have no idea what the requirements are of being organic.
Right.
And they consider themselves to be sustainable farmers because they're starting to use cover crops now. That is my definition of sustainable farming.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm a real strong believer in treating your soil and your crops right.
Yeah. How would you say consumers understand organic?
Not very well. You almost have to know the farmer and maybe live next door to see what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and talk to people, I guess. Talk to people who are involved in organic farming to really know what it's all about.
Yeah. I'm very curious about consumer perceptions, and I think the people who are following it, of course, are very interested in it and believe in the values, but how do you make the case to the people who are skeptical about it, or the people who are, maybe it's a little bit more difficult socioeconomically to buy organic products? So how do you really make the case to people who are on the fence about it?
Yeah, it's, I guess, I mean, it's kind of not up to me to persuade people. But I do like to, when I talk to people, I like to bring out the fact that, you know, if you're eating non-organic grains, you're probably eating something you don't want to eat.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that doesn't tell a story of how you're treating your soil, how you're, growing other crops and building the soil up and not polluting the water systems with things like herbicides and pesticides and antibiotics and all the things that they come along with mm-hmm. conventional agriculture.
Yeah, I'm curious if there's anything in particular that farmers want consumers to understand about organic agriculture or about what they do as organic farmers and why they do it.
Well, for me, I do it as a philosophical way. I just feel like, you know, we've only got one earth. We've only got one chance here, and we need to treat it as well as we can. You know, when I hear stories of, I haven't been hearing this much lately, but, the Midwest was just such a fertile place when us white people came along and started tilling it up. And, you know, they certainly had 8-10% organic matter in their soils and so forth. And now, or at least in what I started hearing about was that, you know, a lot of those soils were down to 1-2% organic matter.
Wow.
And you know, now they're starting, you know, now things, they're starting to say, oh my gosh, if we start growing cover crops in between, mm-hmm. we can keep the organic matter up a little bit. You know, we can actually increase the organic matter a little bit, mm-hmm. and we can get better yields. You know, it's like, wow, what a surprise.
Yeah.
And you know, when you know, as an organic farmer, you're really required to do that.
Yeah.
So you know, it's something that I wish we could demonstrate to people easily. I'm not sure just how we do it. I started, this goes back quite a number of years now, but I started a small group of organic farmers here in Addison County. And we at one point, and one of the reasons I wanted to do it is because I wanted to have it be pretty, you know, kind of political. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be out there and show people, you know, that there is a big difference between organics and conventional farming. And so a lot of the people in the group said, you know, I'm not aggressive in that and so forth. But eventually, we started doing some programs where several of us would speak, or we'd bring a speaker in, mm-hmm. and we'd have it open to the public. Mm. And, you know, not a lot of people came, but anyway, you know, it was kind of, unfortunately, these things tend to attract people who are already, you know, already convinced.
Right.
So, we had Bill McKibben at one point mm-hmm. speaking. I think that's probably where we attracted the most people. But, you know, there were, we had people who owned restaurants come in and speak, and, you know, how they were using the crops that we were all growing and so forth. So they were, I think it was just two of us, myself and Ken Benazga, who lives in Shoreham. We were the only people who were growing grains, but you know, we had, you know, Will Stevens would come all the time, and you know, a lot of vegetable growers. So it was a good way to get information out, but it kind of went by the wayside. I think we lost the enthusiasm to do it or something. So, and now the group hasn't been for 2 years, I guess. So. But, you know, I remember Marie Audette talking to me. She says, you know, you organic farmers know how to get together and do things for yourselves. And we don't do that as, you know, as conventional dairy farmers. Well, now she's doing it. So it was some inspiration she got from what I did there, I guess.
Huh, interesting.
Yeah.
What would you say some of the biggest challenges were that you encountered as a result of being organic?
Oh, probably my biggest challenge was money. I was always trying to get by with older, cheaper equipment, and it always required a lot of maintenance, and I never became a very good mechanic. I just didn't have that kind of training. Mm-hmm. I learned how to weld. That was a very hard to a course, adult education course on welding, and that was a really big thing because my brother left the farm, and he was a welder.
Uh-huh.
He was, you know, not professionally, but he did all the welding. He did all the repairs on the equipment. But once he left the farm, I had to hire somebody or I had to do it myself. So that was a very expensive and time-consuming thing, was to keep that going, keep all the equipment running. And it requires a lot. It required a lot of equipment for, you know, what I wanted to do. So that was one of the biggest issues. I guess just, you know, weather conditions, of course, are always an issue there. I ended up putting a lot of the money I earned off the farm back into drainage because wheat doesn't grow well on wet soil. And it tends to winter kill as well, and that was a big issue that, you know, took quite a bit of money from what I earned off the farm over the years. So there were a lot of, you know, there was a lot that one of the things that I really enjoyed, however, was to when I delivered flour. I delivered, you know, all of my own flour, and I got to know the people that I was delivering to and got to be friends with them. And, you know, I consider I consider Red Hen Bakery to be one of the best businesses in Vermont. You know, they're really great. And Randy George is just the nicest person you ever want to meet. So, and I'm still in touch with him, of course. So, you know, there was a good side to it. I mean, you know, trying to maintain the equipment, trying to deal with being the only person working the farm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was farming alone. And it was a 7-day a week job. And a lot of heavy work,
yeah.
Heavy lifting, things like that. So at 70, what was I, 72 when I sold the farm, almost 73 when I sold the farm.
Wow.
I'm glad I did. I'm glad I did when I did.
Yeah. What would you say, in your opinion, are some of the biggest challenges to the development of organic agriculture?
Well, I think for one thing, it's finding a niche. I know when I, because, you know, there's organic agriculture in the country has changed a lot. It's gone to, you know, there's a lot of very large farms that are organic now. And it's hard for a little guy to get into it. I mean, land accessibility, you know, land prices continue to go up. And you know, it's hard to get started unless you've already had a job that paid you a lot of money and you want to farm when you retire.
Right.
And so that's a really big issue. So for me, you know, when I first started growing food in Connecticut, I quickly started thinking about if I wanted to expand this business, I had to have it a value-added business. And so I knew that when I started growing grains here in Vermont, that I had to start milling. That was the only way to sell them. So it's, you know, and there are so many different, I go to some of the, or I have been going to meetings, haven't been lately,
right?
But going to meetings where these young farmers find something that is unique, and they really get into it, and you know it's really fun to see. It's fun to see these young people who generally tend to be pretty well educated people, and they go out and they do their research and they find something that they want to do and that people want, and then they, you know, they go from there, and you know they have successful farms. So things have changed a lot since 1979 when I first moved here.
Yeah, that's actually a good segue, because I'm very curious about some of the changes that you've seen in food and agriculture, and especially the local organic movement in the last few decades.
Yeah, well, number one, when I first moved here, there were three farms on the road that I lived on in Bridport, and so. You know, they were small farms. Even at that time, Audettes were a very small farm. And, well, very small, I'd say maybe 400 acres, something like that. There was a farm just up the road for me, the Carls, who, they were, I don't know what they had for acreage. They had maybe 300 acres, and they rented other land, and basically, you saw a lot of equipment going from place to place, But you didn't see these big, heavy pieces of equipment that they're using now. I mean, huge tractors, big manure spreaders, big things that compact the roads, mm-hmm. do damage to the roads and that sort of thing. And, you know, like, it was just small, much more small-scale agriculture. And you know, for instance, the Carls lived next to me, always seemed to have more manure than they needed. And I could go up there and get manure from them. And they said, oh, that's great. You know, we don't have to move it out of here. You know? Mm-hmm. And so I'd get, you know, as much manure as I wanted to spread on my fields. And you know, so there was this nice working relationship we had. I used to go and help them unload hay wagons and, you know, with the small square bales. Mm-hmm. And I'd loan them tractors when they were really chopping hay or chopping silage or something like that, you know, something to put on their chopper, mm-hmm. or not their chopper, but their blower that blew it into the silo. And you know, so there was this nice working relationship that we had that we just don't have now with the big farms. And like when Audettes are harvesting, they got land all around me and, you know, on the side roads, not just the road that I live on, and you know, when they get busy, it's just constant traffic with these guys. You know, I think they do a really good job for what they do, but you don't want to get out there with a combine with a 15-foot head on it when they're harvesting, because they got big equipment and you know, a 15-foot head, I mean, you're kind of sticking the head off in the ditch to,
right,
so they can get around it and that sort of thing. We didn't have anything like that when I first moved there, so that's a big change, which to my mind is sad, but you know, it's happening all over the world. The organic movement, what I am seeing, like, in grains, is that there's more interest in growing organic grains, and some of the dairy farmers who are struggling or who have gone out of business and are just renting their land or something like that, they're frustrated because they want to farm, and more of them are starting to say, well, maybe I'll start growing some grains. So we've got a malting business up in Charlotte, I guess it is, and there's going to be a big demand, or there already is a big demand for grains up there, for barley and for wheat and, you know, almost any kind of small grains that he can malt. And then he's got markets with all these small breweries, and, you know, and he does organic and he does conventional both. So it, you know, that kind of helps some of the people who are struggling with their farm, not knowing what to do. But certainly the price, you know, some of the farms that have gone organic are doing it because the price is higher. Mm-hmm. They're not doing it because they believe in it or whatever. They're doing it because the price is higher, and, you know, that's the way they survive. And I guess it's okay, but, you know, I mean, these are people that are going to the supermarkets and buying all their food there, and they don't, you know, they're not really concerned mm-hmm. about what's in the food. It's kind of crazy, but, you know.
Yeah. And then my last question is just about what your hopes for the future of food production are.
Well, my hope is that things change a lot. People start becoming much more educated about what is in their food, about how their food is processed, how it's grown. We have a very dysfunctional food system in the country. My son graduated from UVM. He studied food systems. this coronavirus thing is showing just how vulnerable we are when everything is huge, humongous processing plants and farms that have to throw their milk out when it's all of a sudden the demand isn't there. It's not a great example to show to the world as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping we'll see some big changes there. I was hoping we'd see a big change, once our new election happens.
Mm-hmm.
I really wanted to see somebody young in there. I mean, Bernie Sanders, I definitely supported him, but he was the one that talked the most sense. But Joe Biden is kind of he's too old. He shouldn't be in there. We need somebody younger in there with new ideas. And I'll have to vote for him, but my God, I just don't see the change that we really need. And we need major changes. I mean, we need to change not only how we grow food, but we need to change how we treat people, how employers treat their employees. We need to have a fairer system where everybody gets a chance, not just the rich. And we need leaders who are not just rich people, but the people who are really thinking in terms of how we can make it better for everybody. So, anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. Well, thank you. Those are all of the prepared questions I have for you.
I really miss it in many ways, but working 7 days a week. Well, I still work 7 days a week. But it's on my garden. It's things that I like to do out here, that are just fun to do. So.
Yeah, very.
Kind of making changes. The education is a big issue. I ended up when Heather Darby came along, she started a program where we studied soil, and it was a book called Building Soil for Better Crops. It's a couple of people, Fred Magdoff and Howard Van Ness. And Fred Magdoff came in and lectured to us. He was from Cornell.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody in the group, it was a fairly large group of people who came and learned about how to treat your soil. It made me realize just how little I knew. I didn't have a great education in science for sure. I wasn't interested in it to begin with, but my last 2 years of high school I had the worst teacher ever. And so I had to really do some studying to figure out what I really wanted, how I really wanted to make my soil better and grow better crops and so forth. So, So education is really a big issue, and I feel like most of the young people who are coming into it are fairly well educated. So it's hopeful that way.
Yeah, that's a very good point for sure. A lot of people I knew from Middlebury were very interested in food and farming and going back to the land, working on farms, maybe starting their own farms.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's, do you know Pete Johnson, Pete Screens?
Yep, I know of him. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Well, when he was at Middlebury College, and he came out to my farm a couple times, I think. I used to host college students for some of the programs they had there, and Pete at the time. I had built a hay bale house. Actually, my brother and I built a hay bale house in Connecticut back in 74, I guess it was. And then I built another one here in Vermont. And so Pete got the idea of taking straw and building a greenhouse. And he did that on the campus.
Oh, wow.
Over college campus. And, and you know, I talking to him, I realized, you know, just how devoted he was. And my gosh, he's just a great guy, great farmer. And he's doing wonderful things up there.
Yeah.
So there's one of your college mates, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I'd love to speak to him one of these days. I'm sure he's crazy busy now, but...
Oh, yeah.
I'm just always very humbled to speak to farmers and grateful to live in Vermont, too, of all places.
You know, Bill McKibben wrote about me in one of his books. I was, at the time, Otter Creek Bakery was owned by the Wooliver family.
Okay.
And the Woolivers were... really were producing organic beer. And so when they bought the company, what was his name? Morgan was the one that ended up managing it, but his brother, he and his brother, I guess, were both living in Hawaii. And his brother came out, and I had been selling organic wheat to wheat berries to Otter Creek Bakery before Wooliver's bought it out, but they were using small quantities of it because it helped with head retention on the beer, and they could get it locally, and I didn't have to process it. Well, I mean, I just had to clean it and bag it and stuff, but anyway. When Wolvers bought it, somebody told him about me, and so he came out and visited the farm and talked to me, and I started selling wheat berries to them, and they produced a beer with my wheat berries. They have a whip beer, they called it, which is a white beer. And it's a Belgian style beer, and oh, that stuff was so good. And it was a process where it was not malted, so they had to use enzymes to convert the starch to fermentable sugar. So it was a longer process for them. So, you know, they had to go out of their way to do this, you know, but they labeled it they told us a little bit of a story on the package about how it was from a local farm. And so Bill McKibben, one year, decided to try and see if he could eat not only local foods in Vermont. And he discovered that, hey, this had local wheat in it, you know, a high percentage of local wheat in this beer. And so that he said, wow, I could still have beer, you know.
That's
and
great.
So he wrote about that in the book. And then later on, they changed the formula a little bit and used a Belgian yeast in there, which changed the taste of it, which I didn't like as much. But they put my picture on the six pack and
wow,
the story. And so that was really cool. I got to meet people like, you know, that use spirit and say, oh, you're Ben Gleason. I became famous for a short period of time.
Yeah, that's great.
That was really fun. Yeah. You know, it's nice being in a community of small towns and businesses and so forth. So, you know, Vermont's a great place to live. If you're going to live in the United States, it's a good place.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Yep. Okay, well, I don't want to take any more of your time.
No, thank you very much. I so appreciate you taking the time.